Well, I'm not sure how many people begin their lives thinking, my career goal is to be a lifelong folk singer.
Right. Certainly wasn't mine. No.
In fact, I think your original history would almost be more of a song and dance history than...
In a way, yeah, that's how I ended up. Of course, I was the first waffle in my family, and my father used to think that was very funny. He'd say, Charlie, you're the first waffle. You're the one we should have thrown away. And then he'd guffaw. He was a good at laughing. The big laugh was my dad. But I was the first one, so, you know, what do you do? I mean, my people were teachers and newspaper people. You know, on my dad's side, journalists and Chautauqua public lecturers. And on my mom's side, her generation were all mostly women were teachers or Naval Academy graduates who flew Grumman Wildcats in World War II and things like that. So it was not – there were no musicians in the family. There are now, but there weren't then, back in the day when I started.
But you had a healthy appreciation – For the musical theater.
Oh, that was... I grew up in a little town called Rochester, which is about 25 miles north of Detroit, and my dad commuted. I asked him once, why do you make this commute? He said, well, it's really hard to raise nonconformists on a city block. That was his idea. So I, you know, put you in the country where you can do whatever you want and so forth. And I think that was a one-liner. But the truth is that he did commute for many, many years down to Detroit where he worked. And we grew up in the country and went to little schools, public schools in Rochester. We lived a mile and a half out of town. So we took the school bus. Mrs. Blanchard drove it. And that's how I grew up in Rochester, Michigan. But one of the things that we did was to go to Detroit on weekends, and there were several very nice theaters in downtown Detroit, and it was there that I saw shows like Finian's Rainbow. I still do songs from Finian's Rainbow, and I got a taste of that. And then we had a lot of relatives in the New York area, and I was actually born in New York City, even though I grew up in Michigan. And so I would go back in the summers to New York, and we'd go to the theater there. And it was part of our lives. Nobody made much of it. It was just something that you included. It was enrichment, as far as my parents were concerned. But part of life, that's what you did.
Well, professionally, I mean, you ended up going back and forth between Detroit and New York and New York to Detroit.
Mm-hmm. I did that. Well, I went to school. I did high school, like everybody, and then I was looking at the University of Michigan, and I was looking at Swarthmore, and I traveled around like kids do today, like my kids did, looking at campuses. And at the last minute, in the late summer of 1954, I went to the place where my parents had gone to school, a place called Principia College, which is about 160 miles south of here it's not quite that far. It's 120 miles south of here on the Mississippi in Elsa, Illinois. And I decided it was a beautiful campus, and I met some of the teachers, and it seemed like a good place to go. So I said, okay, I'm going to go here. So I went to Prin, and I got my degree in English and drama. I started out to be a forest ranger, but I discovered early on that forest rangers, at least in those days, were tree farmers. And they ended up working for Weyerhaeuser and so forth. And Aldo Leopold had not become the textbook of the environmentalists and the true believers in taking good care of the environment and so forth. So anyway, I decided I would study English, which was a safe thing to do. And I had a great time and did a lot of plays, built a lot of sets, and got immersed in that whole life. And after I got out of college, I went to New York to become an actor. And I discovered that wasn't as easy as it might appear. So I ended up going to work at the Henry Street Settlement House, where I was also living. And since I didn't have anybody to accompany me, I'd been a singer since I was knee-high. But there were no piano players or guitarists available. And so I thought, well, I better learn how to accompany myself. And I started taking guitar lessons at Henry Street. And I took about a dozen or less, and I got drafted. They drafted me, Kenneth, and they sent me off to Korea. But I took my guitar with me to basic training in at Fort Knox, Kentucky. And I went into the residence hall. That's not what it was. I went into the company where we all lived, into the barracks. And I believe half the kids could take my guitar and just play the hell out of Wildwood Flower and all these other songs. And I could barely go chunka, chunka, chunka and to accompany my Burl Ives as I walked out in the streets of Laredo. But anyway, that's how it started. I got distracted and sidetracked from my career as an actor and spent 2 years in the Army. And did a year in Korea. It was after the war. So, and basically, I was a hoofer. My primary job was as a correspondent for the 1st Cavalry Division Head and Head Company, which led me to be a stringer for Stars and Stripes in Asia. And my thing, what I did that got some success for my career in the Army was that I could get feature articles in the Stars and Stripes. And so the various company commanders of the artillery batteries and tank battalions and whatnot, they were very happy to have me come around because I'd take photos with my little Ryko diacord and I'd go back to the I lived, you know, out on the field in the week, and then I'd go back on weekends, and I'd type up these stories and go to the dark room and do my photos and send the package off to Tokyo, and lo and behold, a couple of weeks later, we'd get column inches and Stars and Stripes, and the commanding officers of these various outfits really loved that. So that's what I did, and then I went to the All-Army Talent Contests in all the years I was there, and each time I would get some kind of a special duty that I really enjoyed. I'd get to travel, and in the case of Korea, I traveled all over the peninsula in trains and buses and however we could do with a company, and we did Broadway shows. We did tunes from Damn Yankees and various other things. You've got to have heart, da-da-dee-da-da. We were dancers, and we had a piano player and a little band, and some of us played guitar. We had a great old time. We toured for like 6 to 8 weeks, and that's what I did. And I came home from my year in Korea none the worse for wear. I had a great time. I was over there. Anyway, that's how it started. And then I came back and I went to work for the Board of Education in Detroit as a staff writer. And we worked in the inner city working with I ended up working on a project financed by the Ford Foundation called the Great Cities School Improvement Project. Even then, back in the day, people were concerned about what they called the culturally deprived. And the idea was that basically our school systems were designed for middle-class kids whose parents taught them things like colors and the hands of the clock, the shorthand and the longhand, and the names of the basic animals and whatnot. And they discovered that unless kids came in with this kind of basic knowledge, they could very quickly get behind. Well, a lot of the Appalachian kids and African-American kids didn't necessarily have the home support that the middle-class kids had. So they named them the culturally deprived, and they set up programs to create, to give them the start that they needed. As a matter of fact, one of the things that came out of this, probably the most memorable and still with us, was this incredible program called Head Start that began in the Cousins School right off the John Lodge Expressway in Detroit, and it was one of the schools that I covered. There were seven schools. And it was one. We had school social workers school community agents, they were called. And we did a lot of stuff, and it was my job to write that up. And when I did, the Ford Foundation paid me to travel around the country to all these various cities, Cleveland, Philadelphia, Atlanta, and various other places all around the country, and write up their versions of the school improvement project. And then I came back and I spent a lot of time in my basement office and I wrote up this booklet about what we were doing. And about that time, I'd been working in saloons, and I began to segue from my day gig as a writer for the school, Great City School Improvement Project, into a saloon singer and a coffee house singer. They were both available in plenty in Detroit back in the day. And that's how I made this thing happen, as you say, with the original question, how do you end up? I didn't have it in mind, but I liked the independence. I liked being able to do a one-man show where I come on and I have my guitar and I sing some songs that I think might interest people. And the big thing is the people have to be there, because the energy that I can generate as a solo artist is relatively small. But if I can get them on board and get them singing and mainly get them interested in what I'm doing, that works really well. So to this day, I've been practicing that particular skill, if you will, or talent or choice. At least we know it's a choice, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but most of the time it works. That's the end of my rap. What's next?
Well, as the one-man show, you worked your way through the country for quite a while. Mm-hmm. But that brings us to wandering back and forth through, well, this little bit of country here.
Well, it turns out that I was raised in the four seasons of southern Michigan and Detroit and Rochester, and I discovered very early on in my career that there were much warmer and more pleasant places to spend the winter. And so I ended up getting gigs in Florida and in California. And I ended up living in Florida and also in California. And then I discovered in Florida that it wasn't so bad. You just had to go north. But in California, when you get out to Los Angeles, which is where I lived in Santa Monica for many years, I discovered early on that it's 1,000 miles to Tucumcari. And there isn't much between the Los Angeles basin and Tucumcari, New Mexico, to work. There's very little work. And back in the day when you could take a red eye from L.A. to Kansas City, it wasn't so bad. You'd just jump on a plane and sprawl across the seats and sleep, and your guitars were reasonably safe in the cargo hold. Now, I can't imagine actually traveling by plane with at least one guitar. I always had a 12-string and a 6-string. So that was a reality for me, and driving that distance was bad. So I ended up moving back to the heartland is what it amounted to. As much as I loved living in L.A. and living in Coconut Grove, I ended up moving back to Michigan for a while, and then I moved to Colorado. And ultimately, I was always on the road, and I always had a little rental place that I lived in. I never owned a house. And then here's where Western Illinois University factors in. In the late 70s, I ended up working a lot in this area, which would include Iowa, Missouri, and Illinois. I worked all of the Iowa universities, Wesleyan, Iowa State, the University of Iowa. I worked St. Louis. I worked, Texas, all those places. And a lot of bars and a lot of coffee houses. And then I found Macomb quite by accident, and I did in 78 and 79, I did 3 residencies here. I had a thing that I did called College and Classroom, and it was basically, the idea was, you have your degree, Chuck, you have your credential in English Lit, so why not go in and offer yourself to English teachers and whoever is interested in having a folk singer come in and sing a few songs and speak some poetry. Because I'd kept up. I do Sandberg, and I do T.S. Eliot, and I do Robert Frost and Gerard Manley Hopkins, whoopee, all these various poets. And I would speak my poems and sing my Flanders and Swan songs and talk about whimsy and wordplay and all the other stuff. It was bull, but it worked, and we had a lot of fun. And so that's what I did when I'd come here, and then I'd work. At that time, maybe you still do, there was a coffee house in the student union. I think it was called the Black Knight or the Purple Knight. It had a name, but I've forgotten what it was. It was 30-odd years ago. But as a result, I would finish my gig here, and I typically would take 67 to 80 and blast out back out to Colorado or wherever I was going. And one time I thought, well, here's this squiggly little highway. It was much more squiggly back then, 136 West. So it was a beautiful September afternoon, and I'd been here for 4 days and sung my songs and done my classrooms and gotten my check. And I headed back to Greeley, where I was living, and I drove 136 and stopped in Carthage, beautiful autumn afternoon, and bought a six-pack. And drove west, and I came to Hamilton, and I went down by the river, and there was this bridge that was open while there was a barge going through. So I sat looking over at the bluffs at this place called Keokuk. And sure enough, when the bridge finally closed and I could drive across, I'd looked at all these big old houses on the bluffs, and I thought, that's curious. I think I'll go there. And if I'd gone straight out Main Street, I never would have come back. But instead, I hung a right on First, and I went up the hill, and I came to Concert Street. Well, that sounded auspicious. So I turned left on Concert. I went a couple of blocks, and here was this big, stark, old brick house with a for sale sign in the front yard. I thought, damn. Maybe I should write that number down. So I did. And then, as I said, I didn't go out Main Street. I kept angling up the river on the various streets. First, inside Keokuk, I went up Grand Avenue. And then down the River Road, and I ended up in Mont Rose. And then I finally got to 61, and I went on and on and so forth. And I wended my way up to 80 through Iowa City and back out west. And when I got to Greeley, I called, and I got this number. And there begins the story, because I ended up, I came back two or three times before I bought the place. I looked at it, and I thought, this is crazed. But I was used to prices for houses in Chicago and Atlanta and L.A., and here was this monstrous big old brick pile that I could get into for practically nothing. So I made an offer, and the people said, we'll take it. And sure enough, they did. The Blooms, they sold me the house, and I moved here. I have, and that's the why not part of it, as we talked, and I did an article last fall. Why not? So if nothing else, it got me back in the heartland, and that's how I started in 1980. I moved here, and I've been here ever since, for better or worse.
Well, after a few other projects entirely unrelated to music for a decade or so.
More like, well, 25 or 30 years. I never stopped traveling and I never stopped singing. But I got distracted because I'd never owned a house. I'd always been a troubadour. My attitude was, I don't want the baggage. But then I acquired the first piece of baggage, which is property, and then later on more property. And the next thing I knew, the woman that I was introduced to by an old architect friend back in Rochester who grew up 3 miles from where we both lived, but was like a half a decade younger than I. It was 10 years younger, so I didn't know her. She came to live here. She thought she was going someplace else, but then she and her golden retriever came to live here, that is to say in Keokuk, and she discovered that she wasn't all that big a fan of Keokuk, but she certainly understood about my nifty house. And when she had a chance to move to Wisconsin, to the country, which is where she wanted to be, so we ended up getting this place up in Wisconsin, which I thought was a summer camp for fun. But she moved there, and the next thing I knew, I was splitting my time between Wisconsin and her country place, which is truly, you know, nearest neighbor's a half mile away, and my little house, my big old brick pile in Keokuk. And that's how that happened. And then, wow, children. Well, that's it, you know. And then comes marriage, and it, the third time was a charm because this one worked. And that happened in 1988, and there it is. That's how it happened. And then the children are here, and all of a sudden you're not traveling nearly as much. You're not on the road. You're not a wandering troubadour anymore. So that's what went down, and then there was the salvage, and then there was the curiosity in, about how this other house that I didn't live in, I could fix that, and I could do this, and I could do that. And the next thing I knew, 20 years had gone by, Ken, and that's what happens. And so I have two kids now, one out of college and one just graduating. And they're both marvelous musicians because their mother got them into Suzuki when they were five. They learned to play Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star on their tiny little violins. And now one is just finished her getting her master's at Yale in viola, having gone to Oberlin Conservatory and College to get that first degree, and she's playing in the New Haven Symphony and looking for other work. And my other kid, my son Will, is out at Pomona College about to graduate, and he makes beats in L.A. for rappers. So I've these two kids, I had nothing to do with it except providing, you know, half the genetic material, and they are wonderful children, and I certainly enjoyed them, but it was their mother who did all the organizing and all of the guiding, by and large. So, I don't know. That brings us up to date. So the big thing right now is all of a sudden I've become a national touring act again in the last year or two. I'm leaving on Monday to go to Coral Gables, Florida for the 50th anniversary of the Flick reunion. The Flick reunion for the 50th anniversary of the Flick Coffee House, which is kind of nifty. And there are a bunch of us going to be down there for a whole weekend. We've sold out this original building that the Flick was in Coral Gables. We're doing two shows Friday, two shows Saturday, and two shows Sunday, and maybe a show on Monday, it's looking like. So that's fun. And I'm going to be going out to California to work a room for a guy I haven't worked for in 30 years. So that's happening, and I'm back on the road, which is kind of neat.
And in the middle of that, now folks will be able to catch you for a few minutes in the hometown.
In one of the best venues that there is along this Mississippi River. The Grand Theater in Keokuk is just a really fine old theater. And I'm going to be there April 5th. In between, right after I've been driving back from Miami from the show at the Flick Annual Reunion Coffee House show. And then I'm going to do the evening with Chuck Mitchell at the Grand Theater on April 5th at 7 o'clock. Should I lay out all the stats now?
Yeah. It doesn't hurt.
Sure. 7 o'clock at the Grand, and it's sponsored by the Keokuk Concert and Entertainment District, KCED. I'm supposed to plug it that way. And tickets are on sale at various places. Look for the poster. It's out there, too. I really can't tell you where they are available, all the places, except one place for sure. They're available online at eventbrite.com. So you can go there and get them, and I highly recommend it. Ta-da!
So what have you packaged up for this particular version?
Of my show?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting how some songs have staying power, depending on how much they involve people and how much they reach people and make them say, yeah, that's the way it is. So I'll be doing some of my own tunes, introductory songs. I'm not primarily a songwriter, although I do it, but golly, there's so many good songs out there. So I'll be doing Cheryl Wheeler songs. I'm going to be doing the Guy Clark song that everybody seems to like for this time of year, Homegrown Tomatoes, is very important. And a song by Fred Eaglesmith called The Rocket. Cheryl Wheeler's song that I dearly love called His Hometown. songs that make people think about the way the world is. I'm old enough now so that I think it's important to be a wise guy in the sense of, well, you get to a certain point in your life when a lot of people that you've, not just your parents, but dear friends, begin to depart. And there's a wonderful tune, a very simple tune that works really well by Tom Paxton called Ramblin' Boy. You can be pretty sure I'm going to sing that. I'm a great fan of Pete Seeger for the obvious reason that his songs about being together are important, and how we relate to each other and the world. There's none better, and I love it when people sing along. Everything I sing practically has a chorus. Homegrown Tomatoes has an excellent chorus, and so does This Land Is Your Land, which we may sing because people like it. I sing You Are My Sunshine, and I combine it with a song which is an orphan song. It has no choruses, called Red River Valley, but it fits right in there. So essentially, I probably will leave my extreme cabaret material, my dark, serious stuff by Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill. I will leave that out, but there are a couple of tunes that Brecht and Weill wrote, one, the Bill Bowles song, which is just this wonderful thing about old places that you once visited, and they were the best places in the world, and then you go back and somebody's messed with them and they aren't nearly as nice anymore. Or is it just that the time has passed and it isn't the same as it used to be? Or maybe you can make it that way. Go back and see what you can do. Those kinds of songs and words. Words to that effect. And, of course, bring your singing voice. I'm going to insist that everybody join in. We've got to get that energy going. It's what happens.
Oh, would you like to give us a little hint?
Sure.
You see me taking it easy, hey, that's what I try to do. In new places, face new faces, sing a song or two. Old soft shoes say, how do you do? Well, I'm a good time raggedy man. I'm playing Raggedy Andy, looking out for Raggedy Ann. Hey, you're a tall one, you're moving so breezy, you'd smile. I do too. And I get this foolish feeling the likes of me likes you. Hey, there's an old soft shoe, say, doodly doo. Well, that's a good time, a rambling man. I'm playing Raggedy Andy. You want to be my Raggedy Ann? I just want to hold your hand. Simple pleasures have their season. Then perhaps some ginger snaps and a cup of tea with lemon. Then an old soft shoe say, how do you do? I'm a good time, a raggedy man. I'll be your Raggedy Andy. Come on, be my Raggedy Andy. You're a ginger girl, an auburn lady, saucy as a mop, but not too easy to handle. Day bright eyes, laughter rising, the night dream soft as the light of a candle. You see me taking it easy, that's what I try to do. But I'm so glad you fancy me. You're happy that I fancy you. So there's the old soft shoe, and I'm happy with you. You got a good time, a raggedy man. I'll be your Raggedy Andy. You be my Raggedy Andy. old soft shoe, and I'm happy with you. You got a good time, Raggedy Man, 'cause I'm your Raggedy Andy, you're my Raggedy Ann. Well, I sing it again, Bing. It's okay, I don't mind if I do. Ba 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 ba.
Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you. Thank you.